Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast where good taste and bad taste are finally back.
Yay!
After a bit of a delay. Well, not a delay. After a bit of a wonderful vacation.
Yeah.
For you.
For me.
I was around.
Yeah.
But you were actually taking a well-deserved rest.
By the way, my name is William DeBiani. I am a film critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a film critic. Tell the listeners about your vacation, William.
So, yeah, for the first time in, oh, God, about 6 years, my partner, M. Lapis da Silva, and I, we actually took a proper vacation. Not a working vacation, not a research trip. We went away for a week. And
for no other purpose than to get away for a week.
Well, which is in and of itself a good purpose, it turns out. I have gotten so wrapped up in work, in my life in general, that I forgot that taking a break from work is actually good for work.
Yes,
you
indeed.
Actually need to recharge your batteries. You need to reset yourself. You need to reprioritize. And I had the most heavenly 7 days, and it was really great, and we had good food, and we slept in, and we watched really old episodes of Doctor Who, and...
Yeah, you met numerous chickens, from what I understand.
That's right. So we ended up, thanks in large part to, almost entirely to my mother, we were actually able to go to Maui for a week, which is just unbelievable. Didn't think we'd be able to do it. And it turns out they have a lot of chickens there, just around... The way that Los Angeles and New York have pigeons, Maui has chickens. You just you get a coffee somewhere and chickens are just walking up to you and be like, "Brack!" And we're like, "Well, yes, fine, here's some muffin. I don't know, what do you want?" And
they,
so
they want some muffin. That's what they want.
They do. They're everywhere. They're delightful. They're various shades of beautiful.
I think some people would argue with the delightful part.
They're wrong. They are full of personality and just an absolute treat. The chickens were one of the very best parts of Maui. Also, the beaches are nice. We went on something called, if you've never been, it's called the Road to Hana. You've been to Maui, right? Did you take the Road to Hana?
My wife and I went for our honeymoon.
That's right. Did you take the Road to Hana?
Goodness, no.
Okay.
No, we started to drive on it by mistake, and then we turned around.
Oh, God. Yeah.
No, we didn't want to drive the Road to Hana.
No, no.
We're a little bit too... snottily urbane.
Well, it's not about being urbane. It's about not wanting to die. See, how the Road to Hana and the way it works is eastern half of the island. I always have to do never eat shredded wheat to remember the difference between east and west.
You just read yeah. from left to right the word "we," and you got it.
I still have to do that in my head before I start saying it. So either way, I'm going to have to pause mid-sentence. But anyway, the eastern chunk of Maui is... nowhere near as developed as the western chunk. It's actually incredibly tropical, and a lot of it's just sort of built into the side of basically a mountain. And they do have a road. The road is kind of 1.5 lanes in both directions. Like,
if somebody's coming down the other way, one of you has to die before the other can continue.
You have to cut every time. There's a lot of like sharper than right angle turns where they're actually signs saying honk your horn so that people know you're coming. There are waterfalls everywhere. It's really, really gorgeous, but it's just an incredibly dangerous. You cannot coast. You cannot say to yourself, what a relaxing, like, no, you have to constantly be on your guard. It's like a water level in a video game. You have to constantly press B to stay out of like the electroshock like eels or whatever. It's not really fun, but it's gorgeous.
Every 10 minutes you have to stop and you have to take a shot of espresso and a shot of gin. And then you have to keep on going.
I don't recommend the gin, but yes.
And then you get to the top and you have to do an obstacle course.
But then, once you're there, they have like the freshest fruit imaginable and these incredibly gorgeous locales, and it's really, really pretty. And I told myself I wasn't going to do it because I was afraid we would, you know, die. But we did it, and what a boost for my confidence. Yeah. Honestly, it was really great. Anyway, it was a lovely time. Thank you everyone for your patience. I know we released fewer podcasts last week than usual as a result of this. But boy, are the batteries recharged, and I'm ready to get back going. So let's talk about what we're going to be doing this week on Critically Acclaimed. We are going to be reviewing the new and semi-new releases, because we missed a week. The Northman, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, Pompo the Cinephile, and Hatching. Mm-hmm. And then before we get into that, there's one more thing I want to point out, which is that my partner, M. Lapis da Silva, they have a new book out. They're part of a new horror anthology called Your Body Is Not Your Body. And this is a new book from Tenebrous Press, T-E-N-E-B-R-O-U-S. Press. It is an anthology from a large number of queer horror authors about horror stories involving queerness and specifically the trans experience. And it has been published to raise awareness and raise money to help trans youths in Texas, which is one of the states where they're basically trying to illegalize being trans, especially for the people who are young. So it goes to a great cause, and it is currently the number one new release in LGBTQ horror on Amazon. So you can get it on ebook. You can buy a print copy as well. M. Lopez da Silva has a fantastic new story. I think it's actually one of the first ones in the book, which is always a treat. Please check that out if you haven't already. It's not currently available. And a lot of great authors are involved in it for a very good cause. So once again, it's called Your Body Is Not Your Body, a new weird horror anthology to benefit trans youth in Texas. And you can get that on a Kindle. You can order a hard copy as well. It's all good.
Order a hard copy. You want a book around, you know?
I recommend if you can get a hard copy, although I think maybe it's only available on Kindle right now on Amazon. But in any case, get it however you can get it. Anyway, that is that for the news.
Unless you count entertainment news.
We don't.
No.
We don't do that here.
In entertainment news, we don't talk about that. But we do review films.
Yes, we do. And let's talk about the film that the big film that both of us have.
The film?
The film. The big film. That both of us have seen.
F-J-I with an umlaut, L-M-M.
Yes, it is a new film from director Robert Eggers, who previously brought you The Witch and The Lighthouse. It is a Viking epic called The Northman. It's where a bunch of those people live up in the north.
The Norsemen. It's about Vikings.
Woo!
It's A.D. the 800s.
Oh, by the way, I stood up and applauded in the theater when the year had AD in the front like it's supposed to.
Not 890 AD, which
no, it was like 895. It was AD like 895, and I was like, yes! Fuck yes! Thank you! Someone actually paid attention in history class. This is great.
Robert Eggers and his co-screenwriter, Sean, wrote this the story based on the ancient Viking tale that is one of the many inspirations for the Hamlet story.
Yeah.
So it's...
Watching this movie, pretty loose. a lot of inspirations, pretty loose. But there's a character named Hamlet.
He's named Umleth, but yeah.
Close enough.
He's played by Alexander Skarsgård. When he's a boy, mm-hmm. his father, who's played by Ethan Hawke, insists that he's going to be the next chief of the village, and they have this weird sort of outward bound hallucination taking experience where they take drugs with Willem Dafoe, and then they started filming. No, I'm kidding. Joke. They start howling, and he sort of internalizes this idea that he is the wolf, and he's going to carry that with him when he witnesses his father get slain by his uncle, and his uncle usurps the throne. And also marries his mother. Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah.
He grows up to be a Viking berserker, and he turns into this big, muscular, giant guy. I feel like Alexander Skarsgård is good, but in a role like this, you need a Schwarzenegger. You need somebody who's like kind of cartoony, somebody who's a little bit larger than life, who doesn't seem to fit in reality to make sort of the myth arc of kind of feel a little bit more alive.
There's these shots early in the film where he his father dies and he vows revenge. And then here's the deal. We see this kid. What is he like? 12, 13?
He's like 12 years old.
Okay. Yeah. And then we cut to, it just says years later, Alexander Skarsgård's 45. He got way late. He got distracted for about 40 years.
Now, I looked this up. Uh-huh. Evidently, Viking berserkers would take a certain kind of like herbal hallucinogen before they went into battle, which is why they were berserk. It's where we get the word berserk, like that's named after that substance.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was called like berserk or something.
Interesting.
And So it's entirely possible he was just zonked out of his gourd the whole time.
Possibly, but either way...
And we get to see him early on, you know, when he's an adult. He's like dancing in skins around a fire. Mm-hmm. Like they're doing these weird sort of animalistic rituals.
There's this big one-shot take of them like storming a village and him like killing everybody and ripping their throats out with his bare teeth. Arr! And at that point, that's when they're trying to sell him as this like big giant... hulking Schwarzeneggerian monstrosity of a man. And then he puts on a snuggly shirt for most of the rest of the film. And I'm like, no, leave it off. Keep it larger than life.
Robert Eggers is notorious for wanting his films to look like they have a little bit of dust on them. He likes sort of vintage-looking movies. He shoots with older cameras and old lenses and
stuff.
He's
also really big on historical accuracy, and that leads to a lot of very, very specific... production design, costume design, and other various looks.
In fact, the look and the filming has such a wonderfully like muddy aesthetic. It's like you feel like you're cold and wet in this movie.
Yeah.
That it's incredibly distracting when every actor seems to be like making up their own accent. It would have been nice if they had cast like all Icelandic actors.
Yeah. Well, they wanted people to actually see it in America. You have Nicole Kidman just thrown in there for funsies.
It's like Nicole Kidman, Willem Dafoe. There's some really like a lot of big names in this.
Willem Dafoe's not in it much, and he's under a lot of makeup. Like you're not, you'd be,
sure he's
you'd
in a
be,
mask for part of it.
You would be forgiven if you didn't even realize it was Willem Dafoe. Like Willem Dafoe is not like I want everyone to know it was me. Like no, he's willing to disappear.
Despite its brutal violence, it's actually pretty arch and arty. I've heard some critics compare it to The Green Knight. It's like based on ancient literature, and they're trying to stage it in this kind of slow, a little bit more contemplative
way.
I actually
completely disagree with that comparison.
I do as well, although I do agree that this is something that's a little bit. It's based on sort of ancient lore,
sure,
classic European lit, and it is sort of this big budget trying to bring sort of like a modern sensibility, I guess, to like this ancient tale. Trying to make it seem like a little bit more of a modern take of this fable.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I kind of wish he had done that more because this is it's a revenge story.
Yes, it is.
He wants to get revenge on his uncle.
All of a sudden, he's 45 years old. He remembers, oh, right, revenge. So, like, he stows away in a ship full of slaves that are being sold to the man who killed his father. And he's going to impersonate one of them, and he's going to, like, destroy him from within. Ha-ha! He teams up with another slave led by Anya Taylor-Joy. Mm. And they have schemes, and it's all going to involve, like, getting involved in their family, whatever like that. They have no idea how close I am to them. I'm going to destroy them all, and I'm going to save my mother from this horrible life she's living in.
The uncle is named Fjolnir, and he's played by Claes Bang,
That's where I recognized him from. Yeah. Okay, yeah. He's in everything. He was Dracula not that long ago.
Last year, I saw, like, Claes Bang in three movies, like in 3 weeks in a row. It's like, where did this guy come from? Like, he has a long career.
He's a good actor. I got nothing against him. Just sort of popped up all of a sudden and everything.
And this movie, without giving too much away, features a scene that I always wish played out this way in Hamlet, in Shakespeare's version of it, where Hamlet confronts Gertrude.
Yeah, that's a very different scene in this movie.
In this one, it goes completely differently than you expect. The problem is, it doesn't really affect the story.
No. Let me try to sum up my... Because I know a lot of people are really celebrating this film. They think it's great.
As you can tell by my descriptions, I was a little bit disappointed by this one. I'm a big Robert Eggers fan.
Again, I try not to build anticipation up before a movie.
Yeah.
So if you tell me a movie is great, I'm like, okay, cool. I'm glad you thought it was great. I'm going to try to see it with as fresh eyes as I can. Even though I liked Robert Eggers' other two movies a lot, especially The Witch, this is its own beast. It's its own entity. So I'm going to try to focus on this film on its own. This is Robert Eggers' Zack Snyder film. This is his Michael Bay attempt.
Brazenly violent, ultra-masculine kind
well,
of...
Well, when you look at...
ideas are being celebrated.
When you look
movie.
At what Robert Eggers did with The Witch, which is a story about pilgrims in early colonialist America who are too religious for the rest of the pilgrims.
They're too puritanical for the Puritans.
So they end up living on their own and then driving themselves mad...
With paranoia about a witch that may be living in the woods.
Or is it paranoia? That is a film that is about, has a lot of historical accuracy in it, but it actually has a lot to say about that time period. The Lighthouse is about a, I guess it's like turn of the century.
Yeah, it's like the end of the 1800s. Yeah. And it's
two guys who are just lighthouse keepers, and that's it. And it's them being isolated and once again tearing themselves to shreds, mentally and eventually physically, as the sort of pent up machismo.
Yeah, well, destroys them. I feel like The Lighthouse was very much an attack on sort of on masculinity.
Right.
You get these two guys together, and what do? They fill each other's mouths with dirt.
My point is this. The Witch is, on the surface, a horror story about family tearing itself apart by paranoia. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a witch. On the surface, The Lighthouse is about two guys going mad in a lighthouse. Maybe there's something supernatural going on. Both of those films have something that The Northman doesn't really have, which is
ambiguity.
I was going to say a point.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, that too.
Because here's the deal with The Northman. It's maybe a point is a little too harsh. It doesn't have any sense of perspective. The Northman is completely entrenched in telling itself. It doesn't appear to be told by a filmmaker who has a distinct point of view on what's happening, other than here's this cool story that I'm going to tell entirely in its own head, on its own merits, as self-serious as it is, with no meaningful commentary on the action or the themes or anything throughout. And as a result, I don't feel like we needed to be told this. This is actually as shallow and pulpy as, not even Conan the Barbarian. Conan the Barbarian, the movie, the first one anyway, has some real meat on its bones. It actually has some depth to it. This is like knockoff Conan the Barbarian in terms of like the actual amount of sort of insight we get about the material.
I understand.
It's just kind of a pulp film.
I understand that. I don't agree that it's a pulp film, but I agree that there's not a lot of nuance to the story, that, that Robert Eggers isn't interpreting the material. This is based on Saxo Grammaticus was the name of the author who brought the story to the modern world. Ancient Danish author. And if you read some of these ancient tales, some of these like bardic fables, as it were.
Yeah. I haven't read this one specifically, but I've read similar stuff.
There's actually not much of an interpretation to those tales.
Yeah,
this is actually
which
just
is why it's an adaptation.
You're sort of picturing yourself around a fire. Mm-hmm. Also, a very ancient person sits on a stone and bends your ear about the times of yore and the violence and how this king came to be. And what's really important to that audience is the power structure and the family and the drama and the violence. The things that now in the modern age are just common tropes of cinema.
Right.
So I understand he's trying to get back to basics, but I feel like he didn't do it enough. He needs to be
more primal, is what you're saying.
He either needs to be more simple and stripped away and have everything be as pure as possible by having everybody speak Icelandic and not try to pulp it up at all, or go the opposite way, go the full Zack Snyder and just make something completely brazenly stupid. For lack of a better term.
It doesn't need to be stupid, it just needs to be a brazenly outré. Like, just go absolutely hog wild with it.
I'm thinking specifically of the film 300 here, which I know is based on a comic book, but that's based on...
But 300 has a point. It's a fascistic point, but it does have a point.
It celebrates fascism, and it's about, if you look at the bookend material,
it's a propaganda piece.
300 is a propaganda piece. It's supposed to serve as propaganda.
The story that we are being sold in 300
is being told by one of the characters.
It's essentially warmongering. It's here, we look at the greatness of war. I don't get that sense from The Northman that Robert Eggers is telling the story because he has a particular reason to, other than to tell it, which I guess is fine. I'm not saying it's incompetent or anything.
Yeah, and it just doesn't. His own culture. He's talking about Robert Eggers is of, from what I understand, is of Icelandic descent.
Cool, which is cool. And listen, and on that level, I guess it's okay, but. It's a long film. It's a frustratingly humorless film. And when I say that, everyone always assumes I mean, I wanted to have jokes. I wanted to have, like, funny side characters. I wanted to be like a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie. No.
I want human beings who have a sense of humor.
What I want is someone in the film to have some sense of perspective. This is something Shakespeare did a lot. Like in King Lear, the jester... is outside of the action enough that they can comment on it. Han Solo in Star Wars, is outside of this really self-serious Luke Skywalker saga enough that he can just have an attitude about it. A film that I feel is... I would be surprised if Robert Eggers wasn't at least interested in it. And it's certainly a film that inspired Zack Snyder, which is why I brought up that comparison. Excalibur, which we recently talked about on another podcast. That is a film that is absolutely self-serious about the King Arthur legend. That is absolutely over the top and absolutely exulting in this glorious lore of the British Isles. But there's also a character in Merlin who knows when people are full of shit and will tell you. He's not breaking the he's not breaking the fourth wall or doing Aladdin jokes where like all of a sudden he's doing something contemporary. He just knows, the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
You're going to destroy a kingdom over this? What are you doing? And I just feel like there's none of that here. There's none of the, there's no context here. And as a result, these characters who get so wrapped up in such bullshit. It's like, okay, so...
Well, and the Amleth character
My father was a good slavemonger king.
Yeah.
This guy is a bad slavemonger king because he killed my father. I'm like, do you have anything to say about that irony? That you're saying this is there's a meaningful difference? No? What are you doing here?
I think it's significant that Amleth is a dumb meathead. Like, he's just a warrior guy. He doesn't have any other skills or any other way of looking at the world. He's not an intelligent character.
Yeah.
I think that's why Hamlet is so brilliant. Get this, like... warmonger kind of role, this guy who has to get revenge, but give him thoughts and morals, and oh shit, now he doesn't know what to do, that's actually a bad thing to do.
So what you're saying is, in Last Action Hero, when they did Hamlet with Arnold Schwarzenegger as Hamlet, it was actually brilliant and not funny.
Sure. I don't know. I haven't seen Schwarzenegger do Shakespeare. Maybe he'd be good. He'd be a good Caliban in The Tempest, maybe.
Maybe.
No, at his age now, he'd be a good Prospero.
There's a scene in The Lost World, Jurassic Park, where the Tyrannosaurus is like rampaging through San Diego, and there's a scene from like inside like a video store, and there's like some fake movies in there, and one of them is for King Lear starring Schwarzenegger.
That's right.
So there you go. In that world, he did King Lear, and I guess he was good.
He's not the most nuanced actor. Look,
so basically what I get out of this is I get this absolutely absolutely sincere. I'll give you sincerity is fine, but not very thoughtful, not very not very potent, honestly. It's desperately trying so hard to be macho that it ends up feeling kind of comedic, and it elicited some like nervous laughter sometimes when it was trying to be super serious, because I'm like, oh come on, you're just being silly right now. Does no one appreciate how silly this is once in a while? Because sometimes it's silly.
There are a few silly scenes where I think that the tension is broken. There's a scene where the Vikings are playing Viking rugby, and they're essentially murdering each other on the field.
That part was kind of funny.
And the Alexander Skarsgård, Amleth, has to tackle the actor who played the Mountain from Game of Thrones.
Oh, I thought he looked familiar.
It's just giant guy.
Yeah.
And they should have cast him as Amleth.
Sure.
This gigantic man.
Let's do it. Ridiculous.
Who I think is also this, like... I think he's also Icelandic. Speaking of Icelandic, this is the fourth film ever... from Björk as an actress.
Yeah, she's in one scene she's technically in two scenes. Mostly in one scene.
Yeah.
As a witch and
a blind seer.
Yeah. And you know who's cool? Björk. Björk's cool in this. She had one scene, but she nails it. She's cool.
And you know what? She's only been in four movies and I've only seen three of them. So
so she was a dancer in the dark, which she's great in. She was in this. What are the other two?
She was earlier in her career. She was in a film called The Juniper Tree, which is an Icelandic film.
Oh, I don't know that
which
one.
I haven't seen. Okay. That's the one I haven't seen. And she was in Matthew Barney's Drawing Restraint 9, which I wrote about on Slash Film recently because they let me do that kind of thing from time to time.
Oh, Slash Film, bless you so much for letting me
write about Drawing Restraint 9
and his weird shit.
Look up Drawing Restraint 9. It's this experimental art film that Matthew Barney did after the Cremaster cycle.
Björk is in the film. That's cool. Mm-hmm. There's some good performances in the film. Some of them are all over the place. It feels like Nicole Kidman's in a slightly different film than a lot of other people sometimes.
Well, and I feel the same way about Anya Taylor-Joy, who plays co-conspirator / potential love interest.
Possible witch.
It's just like some like herbal remedies and like alchemical kinds of things going on. And I think Anya Taylor, she worked with Robert Eggers on The Witch. She
Was like a big breakout role,
main character when she was a teenager. And yeah, here she is. And I feel like, yeah, she was just directed, just be witchy. Like, that was her only direction. Like, she wasn't given a lot of guidance. She has the same accent in this that she had in The New Mutants, which is really frustrating.
Like, there's so much, like, potential nuance to her character. She actually does have an outsider's perspective, I think, because she's literally been taken from where she lives and brought to this new place. She has none of that to offer. She just is dumped in and she becomes, like, basically a co-conspirator slash love interest. For a lot of it. There's a lot made of how this sort of revenge is a cycle. You know, like, I have to get revenge for my father, but then if I kill your family, really then you have to get revenge on me. And I'm like, okay, we're not actually breaking any cycles here. We're just perpetuating him. And we're not really dealing with the fact that Amleth is not much better than any villain in this play or this movie. We don't really seem to be conscious of that.
That is part of this marriage.
It is, but it doesn't seem any. But it doesn't even really feel like that much of a tragedy anyway. It feels like at the end they say, "Well, maybe we broke the cycle." I'm like, I have seen no evidence to support that. I see no evidence to support. There's a really insipid online theory that people have had thanks to the Big Bang Theory. That if Indiana Jones had done nothing in Raiders of the Lost Ark, that everything would have turned out fine.
Before,
which is nonsense, because if he had done nothing, the Nazis would have gotten both halves of the amulet. They would have found the Ark faster. They would have gotten it to where they needed to go. And they wouldn't have all died in the middle of nowhere where Indiana Jones could have rescued the Ark. They would have died in a place where other people have said, okay, well, we know what they did wrong, and then they could weaponize it. So, no, that's nonsense. But in The Northmen, where the whole point is we're trying to break free of these horrible cycles of vengeance. I feel as though...
I don't think that's the point, but
Well, regardless... Okay, then fine. The whole point is supposed to indulge in them?
Just that this was the cycle of life back then.
I guess, but my point is this. If the Northman hadn't done anything, everything probably would have worked out better. If he actually had... I mean, yeah, he's still a monster. He's doing these horrible berserker, kill raids.
Now, there's a scene early on where they lock a bunch of children into a house and set it on fire.
Yeah, but they're going to do that anyway.
Right.
Like, when he leaves, he just makes everything fucking worse over here. And, the movie kind of makes an argument that maybe it's better before he gets there. And I'm like, okay, but are we going to comment on that? Are we ever going to show anyone being the bigger person? No. So, what's the point? Like, seriously, what's the point? I look at this and I see this big exaltation of manly bravado, and there's an appeal to that. I'm not pretending that there isn't. I just find it ultimately frustratingly straightforward, not very thoughtful, and frankly, this feels like any kind of empty summer blockbuster just made with more of an art house aesthetic by a filmmaker who really knows what they're doing. So it's just kind of like
I agree. I think it is disappointingly straightforward. I wasn't so put off by that, but I was disappointed. The idea that this is part of their lives and that this is a cycle that's going to continue, this cycle of revenge and death and violence against one another, is just sort of par for the course. Isn't something that we get to see sort of play out in a larger context. We don't get to see I know it's unfair to compare it to Hamlet, but it's also fair because it's the same story.
Well, it's like when they made that movie In the Heart of the Sea about the story that inspired Moby Dick.
Yeah.
You have to compare it because we know what happens in Moby Dick, Moby Dick is the better version of that story.
A big part of Hamlet is that Hamlet is supposed to get revenge on Claudius and take his rightful spot on the throne so he can sort of face off against Fortinbras, the Norwegian king.
That's the idea.
Who's charging through Denmark at the time and ends up just taking over.
He's like the ticking clock
this outside force. You don't see that in too many stage versions. They cut out a lot of the Fortinbras stuff.
It's easy to cut out.
It's a big part of the play, especially if you've seen Brana's version where he actually includes it.
But much like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, they're easy to cut out if you don't mind losing the themes of the play.
Right. But this idea that Hamlet's actions are going to have larger repercussions in the world is a big part of that play. That it's not just that he's refusing to play his role as this character in a play, he's also not being a responsible politician.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a big part of the full version of Hamlet is that Claudius, although he's a murderer and usurped the throne, is a good politician.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what good politicians do. They murder each other off. Mm. There's none of that sense in The Northmen, that what this character is doing is going to have any larger repercussions other than what it means to him personally.
Right, which leaves
and
it feeling...
And he's such a shallow character.
Yeah, exactly. So it ends up feeling kind of... Which leaves it feeling kind of pulpy to me. It ends up feeling a little bit like that one Ralph Bakshi movie he made with Frank Frazetta, Fire and Ice.
I haven't seen Fire which and Ice, is, but I know what you're talking about.
Basically, hunky Tarzan-type dude teams up with hunky barbarian type dude to save scantily clad lady from frost wizard. And that's kind of it. Even Ralph Bakshi admits that movie's really shallow.
Got yourself a movie there.
But he did it so he could work with the brilliant Frank Frazetta, who's one of the great pulp artists of all time. It's kind of unapologetically shallow.
Mm.
Like, at least that one's just like, we're not pretending we're more than we are. Here, it's so self-serious, and it's so melodramatic, and it's got so many, like, big images, and so many huge set pieces about religion, and family, and legacy, that when, at the end of the day, you realize we didn't really get much out of it. It kind of feels like maybe this should have been 90 minutes.
Instead of 2 hours and 20.
Like, maybe this didn't need to be this giant thing. Maybe this is like a, maybe it could have been a little punchier and we would have gotten away with it better. But anyway, not a huge fan. But tell me about a movie, I didn't get a chance to see this because I was away.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, which I keep wanting to call a heartbreaking work of staggering genius.
Also by N. Eggers, so there's a little bit more of a confusion there. Not Robert Eggers, though.
Different guy.
David Eggers. If you were in your 20s in like the early 2000s, you read that book. Yeah. That was really important.
I guess I was the one who didn't.
Okay, yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah, it was being spread around. It was nominated for a Pulitzer, but it didn't win. And it's a true story about this guy who was lost both of his parents very rapidly to cancer, and how he, as a young man, had to raise his brother and sort of survive as a young man, and just sort of his experiences. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. This is a film, which is a concept that's been done numerous times in cinema in the past, where we're going to make a fake autobiography of a living actor who is playing themselves.
Yeah, that happened a lot, but when they do, it's fun. W.C. Fields did that. What was it called? Never Give a Sucker an Even Break. Okay. I think that's a fun one.
In recent year, I recalled Being John Malkovich,
sure.
Which is a little bit more of a surreal thing.
Yeah,
but
very fanciful,
a little bit more directly. It's a lot like JCVD, about Jean-Claude Van Damme, and sort of he plays himself in that, but he also... It's a fictionalized version where he's part of like this bank heist, and now he has to play the action hero in a bank heist, but he's playing himself.
Did you ever see that Paul Giamatti one where he played himself?
Oh yeah, Cold Souls.
Where like they remove his soul and it looks like a chickpea.
Yeah,
I don't remember anything else happening. Honestly,
the premise of that movie is this fantasy concept. You can go to this clinic and they'll remove your soul and they store it in a jar. And everybody's soul looks different. His looks like a chickpea. Sometimes they look like liquid. You know, whatever it is.
Like the new fat. And,
And he feels that in order to, if he loses his soul, he'll be a better actor. He can be a little bit more pliable. He can pretend to be others without his own weight of his own soul. And then he says, I can't do that anymore. I want my soul back. But they give him somebody else's. And that's the conceit of that movie.
Yeah.
But they give him, like, the soul of, like, this like, suffering mother from Russia who raised orphans. And it's, like a very big soul compared to his. It's like, I can't handle that anymore.
Yeah.
Really, really close to this Nicolas Cage movie is My Name is Bruce, which was the Bruce Campbell movie, which he wrote, and I think he also directed.
I think he directed it too, where he goes to like a small town and they confuse him for his character in the Evil Dead movies and he has to fight monsters.
They don't confuse him, he's Bruce Campbell, but they assume that he has monster fighting skills because the nature of Bruce Campbell's fandom. That's the way people react to him in public. So he wrote himself that way in this movie. But in that movie, he plays sort of like in all of these movies, in fact, these actors play sort of like sad, beaten down versions of themselves.
Yeah.
Like kind of bastard versions of themselves, kind of,
that's true. That
kind
is
of
weird
egotistical versions of themselves.
It is weird that almost all of those examples, even the W.C. Fields one I gave you an example of, they're never happy.
Yeah, they're never like...
Even in Last Action... I guess Last Action Hero is the one exception, but like even the fantasy
version...
But
he's not playing Schwarzenegger.
For like
that.
A
he's
brief
playing,
second he is.
I guess, but yeah. That's not about the life of Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, I guess not. I guess it's not an example. But yeah, no, it's weird.
But yeah, in this one, Nicolas Cage, playing himself, is now like struggling. Mm-hmm. First scene in the movie, he's having lunch with David Gordon Green, who plays himself. Oh, okay. He's like, hey, I'm on an audition. I want to be in your movie. Can I read for you? No, you don't need to read for me. Well, I'm going to do it anyway. And he gives a speech out in public. He's overacting like crazy. Mm-hmm. He's playing the version of Nicolas Cage that
people
popular perception has of Nicolas Cage, that he's sort of this irresponsible, crazy, wild man kind of a guy. Because he plays crazy characters a lot.
Well, it's almost like when...
but he also plays very subdued characters a lot.
It's also like that movie Free Enterprise, where William Shatner plays himself, but William Shatner, and to be fair, very game, plays himself as a bad actor.
Mm-hmm.
Shatner can be a good actor if he wants to. He doesn't always want to. But
the joke in that movie is that Shatner, like, he gets the attention of these two, like, 20-something Trekkie guys, and he's like, I want to do a movie. He's like, oh, heck, we're kind of getting on our feet. We could produce your movie, William Shatner. We're big fans of yours.
Mm-hmm.
He says, okay, I want to do a 6-hour musical version of Julius Caesar, and I'll play all the parts. And they're like, what? He's like, no, it's a great idea. And he just talks about the stupid Julius Caesar project throughout the entire thing. At the end, he raps Brutus' speech. I like Free Enterprise a lot.
It's a cute film. I got nothing against it. My point is this. He's willing to play up this idea of himself rather than actually try to accurately represent who he really is.
This popular idea of who Nicolas Cage is has sort of grown up over the course of the last decade. That he had a lot of financial troubles kind of fed into this.
Because
he made a lot of very extravagant purchases. He bought castles and villas. He bought a dinosaur skull at one point.
Action Comics number one. Which he eventually sold. And I heard he didn't want to. And that kind of broke my heart a little bit.
Yeah, well, and he was going to play Superman in that one project.
Yeah.
That he actually didn't get to do. Would have been weird. The dinosaur skull he gave back. It turns out it was stolen from the Macedonian government and given to the auction house. So he bought it, he paid the auction house, and then they said, wait a minute, that's not theirs to sell. So he was...
Just took a bath on it and gave it back.
Yeah, he said, okay, I'll give it back, and the auction house can give me my money back. And the auction house didn't do that. So he kind of got stiffed in that.
That sucks.
He's still...
Good for him for doing the right thing.
He still bought a dinosaur skull, though, so that's a little bit extravagant.
I might do the same thing.
Yeah, I was about to say...
That's not something I wouldn't do.
If I was a millionaire movie star, I would want to buy some extravagant things.
I mean, what's the point if you don't get to enjoy it once in a while? Exactly. You know, you want to do a couple of weird things,
it's like, okay,
right?
Here's my home. It's nice and modest. What's in the basement? 1985 arcade.
Yeah!
50 pinball machines.
You got to have at least one thing. If you're a millionaire, listen, especially... If you had to work for it.
Uh-huh.
Not if you grew up with it and you had everything handed to you in a silver platter, which, let's be honest, some people do. Not many, but that's the whole point.
Nicolas Cage kind of did, because part of a legacy.
He's from the Coppolas, but they weren't famous. They weren't super rich the whole time.
No.
But in any case, especially if you worked really, really hard for it, you should get something weird. You should get your own car with a jacuzzi in the back. You get one thing, right? Just one.
Someone once asked him in an interview, what would you call your... Because he does have a pretty unique acting style.
Yeah.
And somebody said, what kind of an actor are you? And he said, he came up with the phrase nouveau shamanic.
Yeah.
And he's explained what that means. Nouveau is like a new version of a shamanism.
Yeah.
Like he's using...
Losing
old,
yourself.
Yeah, losing yourself in sort of these roles. Nouveau shamanic. Mm. It actually makes perfect sense. It just sounds a little bit kooky.
Well, it's a name, but like... But
he takes his craft seriously.
Well, Nicolas Cage can underplay. Like, if you look at like the way he plays in the movie Pig, which is one of his best performances, and it came out last year, that's not a nouveau shamanic role, or at the very least, it's not outwardly so. Mm. It's actually very understated.
Yeah.
But then you look at something, and I will go to bat, by the way, for Nicolas Cage's performance in Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance. Not the first one. The first one is bad. The second one, he is on another level of weird. Mm. He's not just playing, I'm a tortured soul and sometimes I turn into a demon. He's playing a guy who is constantly physically fighting. It's like
a demon
it's like,
that's trying to burst out through his skin.
Imagine a werewolf movie where literally every second you were like on the verge of transformation. Hmm. Like that's how he plays that role. I kind of love it, actually. I really think it's fun in that.
Do you remember that like Weasley sidekick character from Bordello of Blood?
You're gonna have to
it's like, the guy, the like really twitchy guy was like eating raw meat. And he's like, you're gonna get so much good sex. Like that guy's like, he looks like he's about to like set himself on fire with his own mind. That actor was so great. I need to look that guy up. Okay. Bordello of Blood is shit, but yes, I love it. It's a piece of shit that I love. Like I can't apologize for it. It's just something I'm drawn to.
But every once in a while you see this like over the top performance and you realize that is not bad acting. That is good acting.
It's just big That's acting. Just,
like for example, people pointed this out, Toshirô Mifune, one of the great actors. His performance in Seven Samurai is very broad.
Because
he's playing a guy who is overcompensating for the fact that he feels like he's nobody.
Yeah.
So he plays it very, very big. But once you actually get to know the character, he realizes the reason he's acting that way. Mm. It makes sense in the right context.
Toshirô Mifune, one of the best actors ever, by the way. Watch the film I Live in Fear at some point. He made that one with Kurosawa. And he was like 35. He played a 75-year-old man without makeup. And he's completely convincing.
Oh my God.
Back to Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, he plays this sort of egotistical version of himself. He's also haunted by a young version of himself.
Hmm.
And there's a digitally de-aged Nicolas Cage in the scene with him.
Convincing?
Sort of appears, ish.
Okay.
And this character, Nicky Cage, is the one who's constantly pushing him to be a movie star, whereas he is a little bit more content to be an actor.
Right.
And those are two different things. He also, in the fictionalized version of this movie, is on the outs with his wife and his teenage daughter. Fictional characters. He actually doesn't have this wife and this daughter.
Right.
He does have a wife and child, but not these. His teenage daughter is completely embarrassed by him, and he is constantly trying to show her his favorite movies and turn her into a Nicolas Cage Jr., and she resents that, and her mom also resents that.
Okay.
He can't get any work. In order to make a lot of money, he's agreed to take a job from his agent, played by Neil Patrick Harris, another actor who did the same shtick in the Harold and Kumar movies.
Oh, he did, didn't he? Yeah.
Again, playing this like broad evil version of himself in those movies. Says you can take this job. It pays a lot of money. You have to spend the weekend at like the private villa in Spain with this kind of sketchy, perhaps criminal warlord type of a guy.
Mm-hmm.
Who is just a big fan of yours, and he wants you to go to his birthday party.
It's like when Dennis Rodman went to North Korea. They were just a big fan of Dennis Rodman.
Yeah. So this guy, Javi, he's played by Pedro Pascal. He's going to pay Nicolas Cage $1 million to hang out with him at his birthday party. And it turns out he's the world's biggest Nicolas Cage fan. And we learn over the course of the movie his three favorite movies, and he's very upfront about the first two. He really loves Face Off. That's his favorite movie.
Okay.
Second favorite movie, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. That's a running gag in the movie. They talk about that one a lot. And he's very coy about the third one. And after they drink a lot and they take some drugs and they have a few more adventures, it's like, okay, you gotta tell me your third favorite movie. It's Paddington 2. So they watch Paddington 2, and Nicolas Cage agrees that Paddington 2 is a brilliant work of genius.
I'm gonna just say it. Paddington 2 is great. I got nothing against Paddington 2. I'm not gonna slag on.
I'm not gonna
be mean to Paddington 2 right now.
That Paddington 2 has itself taken off into the sort of like mythic lore of cinema. Yeah.
But I'm just gonna say this, and I know where this is gonna sound. I still think Paddington 1 is better. Like, they're both wonderful, right? Mm. It's just this sort of thing where it's like when everyone says Troll 2 is the worst movie ever made. You know, Troll 1 sucks
Troll 1
too,
is
right?
Also quite
but very entertainingly bad. I just feel like Paddington 1 is just a kind of a better cohesive film.
Paddington 2
is very sweet.
I like Paddington 2 better. I like the prison stuff in Paddington 2.
The prison stuff is glorious in Paddington 2.
I like Hugh Grant in Paddington 2, and there's less of the, like, bear cleans his ears with a toothbrush stuff.
And ordinarily, I would not be for that, but I actually think they get away with it in Paddington 1.
I was grossed out by the digital bear earwax scene.
Well, that you were supposed to be, so I think it's fine. It wasn't, the director wasn't just like, I know what Whitney Seibold will love. He'll be like, I want to, that makes my appetite swell. I'm going to go get a snack.
When Nicolas Cage arrives to spend the weekend with Javi, wouldn't you know it, there are CIA agents at the airport, and they know that he's going to this mansion. They know something, that Pedro Pascal is up to something. So they track Nicolas Cage, and the CIA agents are played by Tiffany Haddish and Ike Barinholtz. So, comedy characters.
Right.
Tiffany Haddish and Ike Barinholtz are fine actors, but they're comedians. They eventually manage to get a hold of Nicolas Cage, and they ask, you have to start spying on this guy. So he starts doing, like, spy stuff. You have to, like, sneak around during parties and replace microfilms and not microfilms, okay, but, so you know, now computer disks and stuff.
So now it's,
and it becomes a little bit more of an action picture, and eventually there's going to be, like, shootouts and chases where Nicolas Cage is working for the CIA and
determining
what his relationship with Javi is going to be.
Now it just sounds like the movie The Interview.
A little bit,
with
I suppose.
James Franco, yeah. Where like they go to North Korea. They're buddy buddies with this guy who like wants to meet him because he's a huge fan. They become a huge fan. He actually, like, James Franco starts thinking this guy's actually really cool, and then it all descends into action movie madness at the end.
Same thing.
Okay. It's a format.
There is a really funny, it's a comedy film, there's a really funny scene where they take acid together just as a bonding exercise, and they are just sort of sitting talking about, you know, what's going on, we're taking acid, I'm getting really paranoid. There's no like special effects or anything, we just get to see how foolishly they're behaving. And they look over at these two guys looking at them. Oh god, they're looking at us. And they go like running down hallway. Oh no, they're gonna chase it. Like, they're so paranoid. Yeah. They come to this wall and they have to scale it to get away. And they say, no, you have to leave me behind. It's this big dramatic thing. And then they just sort of walk away. Oh, I guess we didn't need to climb that wall. Like, they start to sober up. That's a good moment. It's a good bonding moment. It's a good comedy moment. Both Pedro Pascal and Nicolas Cage are really there for that scene. By the time it gets to the action stuff, it's really cheap. It's really kind of dull. It's not entirely entertaining. This is a trifle of a movie. Like, Nicolas Cage is just playing around. He's not making any kind of real serious comments on his own career. It's not even adding to the Nick Cage myth. It's just sort of commenting that it exists.
It's a bit of a missed opportunity.
Yeah, like, you'd think there would be a way for, like, there's a scene in JCVD where Jean-Claude Van Damme turns to the camera and gives a monologue about,
that's like the end of the movie. It's a really long monologue about his whole career and legacy
in popular culture. And Nicolas really Cage doesn't have a moment like that in this. He's just sort of playing around. And that's fine. Nicolas Cage can play all he wants. And he's played playful roles. He's played very serious roles. He's played a lot of action roles. His action movies are brought up more often than, you know, Joe or Pig.
Did you ever watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine?
No, never saw it.
There's Andy Samberg's character is a huge Nicolas Cage fan, and there's a whole part where he has to go to the mattresses with his boss's husband, who is very effete, high art, you know, snooty opera type guy. And to entertain them, he's brought every Nicolas Cage movie. And watching Gone in 60 Seconds is just, like, killing this guy's soul. And then at the end, when they manage to, like, save the day, and the guy actually, like, manages to do so by remembering something Nicolas Cage did and, like, I don't know, Con Air or whatever like that. He's like, you were paying attention. He's like, yeah, well, you know, there's bound to have been something good in there. And he's just like, yeah, we didn't even get to Captain Crowley's mandolin. There was a movie about a mandolin? Yeah. Oh, you probably would have also liked Leaving Las Vegas. He worked with Mike Figgis! Like, he never showed him any of the good stuff. Yeah. He only showed him this cheesy action stuff.
I am a Nicolas Cage fan. I do admire, like, how wild he can get. He's really great. I think his craziest role might be
Vampire's Kiss.
Well, I was going to say Bad Lieutenant. Bad Lieutenant Porter from New Orleans is pretty good. The film he made with Herzog, that's a pretty crazy flick.
Vampire's Kiss is the one where he actually eats a cockroach.
That's
for real.
That's commitment. He ate a real cockroach on camera. You can see how grossed out he is by it, too.
Yeah, that's gross. Great actor. But it's a fun, though. It's okay.
It's fun. Like, it's fun, but it's, like, kind of light and forgettable and really cheap. And not you know, it's something to just sort of, like, waste your time rather than bring anything serious to the conversation about acting or the craft or Hollywood or Nicolas Cage.
It's interesting.
I wish it had gone a little further. I wish it had a little bit more of a comment, but still entertaining.
It's interesting that we've had, like, two movies. One is, like, kind of this, like, big art house film from a celebrated art house filmmaker, and one is more of a trifle about sort of behind the scenes Hollywood. And then the next film we're going to review is a film about those things.
Okay.
It's called Pompo the Cinephile.
Hooray, we got a theme.
That's true. And actually, it's an interesting film because it's actually, whereas those two films, I feel like, I mean, it sounds like, you know, Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent seems like it just wasn't about very much at the end of the day, and kind of felt the same way about The Northman. Pompo is about trying to make something meaningful out of often crap. Pompo is the name of a movie producer in Nyollywood.
Meowlywood.
No, Nyollywood, which is Japanese for meow. Meow.
Oh, okay.
So then in this slightly fictionalized version of Hollywood.
Is it a Japanese picture?
Yeah, it's an anime film.
Oh, okay.
In this slightly fictionalized version of Hollywood, where, like, instead of having stars on the Walk of Fame, they're like cats, like cat heads. It's like basically just see, it's kind of like, it's not the Academy Awards, they're the Nya Academy Awards. Everyone on board with this? Everyone see the subtle joke? Pompo is the name of a young movie producer. She is, I think it was like her grandfather was like one of the greatest filmmakers in the world, and now she is running a studio, and she's like a young Corman. Everything she makes is B-movie schlock, but everything she makes is good, and everything she makes makes money. She has a new script that she has written that is actually a thoughtful, serious drama about a music conductor who finds his muse in the Swiss Alps. And one thing I appreciate about the film is that there's a scene in the movie where they admit it's a really trite premise. But, you know, once you actually read it, it's pretty good. Which gives you a lot of freedom to make like a movie within a movie not look that good, but just trust us, if you watched it, it would win you over. Which is a clever play, I think, because the movie within a movie never looks good. They never look like a good movie. It's always, I don't know, sometimes it's a joke. Sometimes it's just a way to differentiate between the actual movie you're watching and the fake movie.
That needs to be done because you're watching a film, and a filmmaker can only make a film so many ways, so they kind of do it like really over the top.
Well, you also don't want the audience to get more excited to see the fake film than the actual film you're watching.
I think it was Luke Y. Thompson recently pointed out that the fake movie at the end of the movie The Player, the one that was supposed to be like the Hollywood sellout ending, the big stupid cheesy movie, looks way better than a lot of the mainstream movies we have now.
He's not wrong.
Like, the joke in the movie was, oh, we always cast movie stars, and we have big, stupid, artificial happy endings on these big dramas. Like, I would kill for that now. Kill for that fake thing at the end of The Player.
But anyway, the idea of Pompo the Cinephile is she's written a real drama, like a serious drama. And she wants her assistant.
It's called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
It's called like the maestro, basically. She wants her a personal assistant, who she hired because she saw a lot of potential in him, to direct it. It'll be his first feature. And she's got like an old classic actor who's like Daniel Day-Lewis has come out of retirement for it, and they found a young ingenue who's making their first movie, and she's gonna make it this big deal. The first half of the movie is. She sees talented people and she gives them a shot. And it's this whole big fantasy about, we get to make
talents where she can,
you can recognize talent in others, which is a huge thing. And this is a huge part of being a producer, which is fair. You have to recognize who has talent and who will work well with each other. That's a massive part of it. First half of this movie is just fantasy fulfillment, everything coming together. And it's great. The second half of the movie is, okay, we have 72 hours of footage. Edit that shit together. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. And now the guy's just like, the fuck do I do now? The second half of the movie is literally all about kill your darlings.
Okay.
He's so in love with everything that he's done, he can't admit to himself that you don't need it. And this is actually a great lesson for every filmmaker to learn, and really every artist.
Especially in film, especially in screenwriting in particular. But
Well, because the thing is, when you make a movie, you shoot every single thing on the page, sometimes more. You shoot different angles, and when they say something like, oh yeah, the first cut of, I don't know, Doctor Strange was like 5 hours long, they don't mean that's the director's cut. What they mean is
that's all the rough footage.
That means when you just take literally everything you shot and put it into the movie, that's how long it would be edited together.
And that's when they start editing to make the movie.
Because that is going to be a shitty movie most of the time. you need to actually have things like pacing. You need to understand when scenes and dialogue and sometimes whole characters and subplots are redundant or distractions. And this guy can't bring himself to do that. He can't figure it out. Mm. So that's why we call it Kill Your Darlings. The idea is sometimes in order to make the movie or the novel or whatever you're doing better, you have to edit out something you really like from it. Maybe even the reason you did it in the first place is the thing that's holding it all back. And once you remove that, all of a sudden the movie is better. Mm. Ultimately, the point of Pompo the Cinephile is not to be so goddamn precious about your filmmaking, because you'll make better films that way. And also, as Pompo says, every movie should be 90 minutes long. That's actually a major point of the film.
Oh, that's great.
And I like that they don't even say, because like as like some kind of old school way, Pompo is actually like, listen, it's a 21st fucking century. People are busy. Making a movie longer than that is rude. So I kind of appreciate that we have here is a film that actually is, on one hand, the kind of like fantasy wish fulfillment Hollywood story about being, you know, having someone notice your talent, and there's a place for that. It's very sweet. But the second half is actually kind of rich, thoughtful film criticism about why it's important sometimes that movies not be 4.5 hours long. Uh-huh. Why sometimes it's important to just tell the fucking story, The Northman. I appreciated that. Ironically, for a movie that is itself 90 minutes, by the way, bravo for commitment. Bravo. Mm-hmm. Still feels a little padded.
Well,
it feels like they actually had to
get it up to 90.
I know, right? So there's this like bit towards the end where like Pompo has cut his film down, but even then he realizes it's like missing something and they need to do reshoots. Mm. You're a major productions company. You budget for reshoots. Yep. That's what you do. It's weird that this is all this behind the scenes stuff and we're making a big deal about having to raise money for reshoots, and we have to have this whole story about this banker who's having a crisis of faith and will he or won't he help them get their budget. And I'm just like, you know, I don't need any of that at all.
This was a short, you guys.
This could have been 80 minutes, I feel, pretty tidily. But it's a sweet film. I don't love it, but it's definitely, if you love anime, definitely worth a shot. And it's an interesting film about filmmaking. Not amazing, but at least it actually tackles some elements of filmmaking that other movies don't really talk about. So I like it. I don't love it. Bada bing. And then the last movie that we're reviewing is Hatching.
Let's bring this back around to Scandinavia.
Woo!
This is a Finnish film from a director named...
you can do it.
I just had her name in front of me.
I believe you.
Hanna Bergholm is her name.
Cool.
And, this is a about a Finnish family. Mother, father, son, daughter. And everything in their existence is white. The buildings are white. Their clothes are white. They're very white. They're very blonde. The teenage girl, she's like maybe 13, is trying to become a gymnast, but she's not good enough for mother. Mother's a little bit of a perfectionist. Her mother also has a little bit of a dark streak. Early in the movie, something that is not white infiltrates their space. A crow gets inside. Mm. The color is used to great effect. And the mother catches it, breaks its neck.
Yeah.
This will inspire the teenage girl to go out into the woods later on. And when she sees an injured crow, she kills it with a rock. Mm-hmm. She sees that it's suffering. Because it's injured. It's dying.
Well, I mean, but it's still sad. Yeah,
and so she
I can kind of, mourn.
So she has this moment to like, I'm going to do what my mother would want me to do. So she crushes it with a rock and then notices that it has an egg. Mm. It was, and she feels bad. So she scoops up the egg and brings the egg home.
Okay.
She puts the egg in her bed. She's going to warm it. She's going to hatch it.
Okay. I saw this episode of The Simpsons. Everything's going to be great.
You didn't see this episode of The Simpsons. The egg doesn't hatch right away. It gets bigger. The egg grows, like still in egg form. Until it's about, 3 feet tall. It's this gigantic, Trumpy-sized egg. And when it finally does hatch, I mean, it's called hatching, this thing comes out. And she names this thing Allie. And this thing is a monstrous crow person thing. It's this monster thing.
Okay.
Like, it's got big, huge, human-size eyes, but also, like, this big, freaky beak, but also has, like, human skin.
Practical
also,
CGI? Like,
practical.
Does it look cool?
It looks pretty cool. It's pretty freaky looking. And also, it has, like, psychic ET linking powers to her. So when one of them gets injured, both of them feel it. So it's this weird sort of, like, doppelganger creature thing. And it starts to grow and change and look more like her as time passes.
Okay.
It becomes this weird kind of doppelganger, this kind of animal spirit of hers.
Mm. Okay.
That sort of is manifesting a lot more of her intense emotions. What the teenage girl is going through at the time is her mother calls her aside, her like mother that she's trying to emulate, this kind of like perfect family woman, and says, "I have a confession to make. I'm in love. I have a secret boyfriend on the side, this like handsome carpenter dude. And I'd like to bring you around to meet this guy and let you know how much I'm in love with this man." The husband doesn't know about this. She's just sort of having this affair and is trying to get her teenage daughter to sort of be cool with all of this.
Okay.
Which is, as you can imagine, putting a lot of strain on her and making her feel really awful about her mother.
It's weird.
It's really kind of strange. In a family dynamic sort of
way. Yeah, it's asking a lot.
Hatching has the same plot and themes as Turning Red, which is about an oppressive mother sort of putting a lot of pressure on a teenage girl who now has this sort of spirit guide to the sort of spirit animal form, essentially, to guide her through and let her manifest her emotions in a little bit more of a direct fashion. Turning Red is a delightful family movie about a young girl who turns into a big red panda. And she's big and cuddly, and she wants to raise money and go to see a boy band.
So cute!
This crow monster is fucking disturbing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it bleeds. It's constantly drooling and, like, giving off bird glop of some kind. It's really kind of... like, you almost smell this thing. It smells like a chicken coop. It's really awful. The fact that the bird monster itself is so scary is a good reason why this movie works. The themes are actually pretty easy to suss out. It's not terribly sophisticated, but it's scary, and that's the important thing. I appreciate it, like, by the end, it sort of starts to take a few unexpected turns when a big part of the movie is the girl's trying to keep the bird secret. She's trying to keep it in the house. It's like Trumpy in that regard. I'm going to, like, sneaking food back to the room.
We're talking about the movie Pod People, by the way.
I think people know who Trumpy is.
Just in case you don't.
Trumpy is like Luke Skywalker or Dracula.
Okay.
Every kid knows who Freddy is. It's like Santa Claus or King Kong.
I don't think Trumpy quite has the market penetration of Freddy Krueger, but okay.
Just you wait.
Watch the MST3K episode Pod People. It's one of the best episodes. There
when they make Trumpy an origin story. Trumpy the college years, whatever they're going to get to. I'm sorry I made all these comparisons to Pod People.
Okay.
Pod People was an ET knockoff, and I already compared it to ET, so it's somewhat apt, right?
I'm not saying it's not apt. I feel like sometimes you and I have a tendency to throw out references all willy-nilly.
Yeah.
And sometimes we have to remember that not everybody has seen that one episode of that show that got canceled in the 90s. Maybe a helping hand bring people along this journey with us.
In the early 80s, I think it was a Spanish production company made a film. It was Juan Pinker Simon Simon was the name of the filmmaker, and he made a knockoff of E.T.
It was supposed to be a horror movie about aliens killing people, but E.T. had just come out and was really popular.
They
changed it so it was a little bit more magical and friendly, and alien befriends a child while it's killing people.
Finds an egg and warms it in his bed, and this little thing hatches out, and it's got this elephant snout and a furry body, and it
does magic stuff,
suit,
makes his toys play in the without anyone touching them. It's stupid as shit.
The little boy is dubbed by it sounds like an adult woman, so he has a really strange voice. Like, Trumpy, you can do magic things. That's what I'm alluding to when I talk about Trumpy, because he names this thing Trumpy. It's ridiculous. It's an amazing movie. It's an amazing episode of Mystery Science Theater. But Hatching also has the egg, also has a Trumpy, but imagined if Trumpy was, like, truly disturbing.
Nice.
And actually, it goes to sort of this teenage girl's, like, inner emotional state. And I think there's actually a really good message going on here about sort of the two selves we live as adolescents. Sort of a lot of new emotions are coming in. We start feeling things a lot more intensely. We have things like jealousy and rage and in ways we didn't have when we were younger children. And this is a good metaphor for that. I feel like it's just really, really well put together. It's really nice. Good horror movie.
All right, well, I didn't see it, so I have nothing to comment, but sounds good. Let's review our movies on the critically acclaimed scale. Once again, for those who do not know or maybe are new, the critically acclaimed scale runs from C- to C+. The lowest a movie can get is a C-. That's below average. That's just not very good, that is. C is average, some good, some bad. Maybe some audiences will like it more than others. It's average, it's a C. And then a C+ is above average. That's the highest you can get. That's everything from we just like this movie to we think this is the best movie ever made. Anything in that range, boom, C+. And on that note, Whitney Seibold, what do you give Hatching?
You know what? I can't find fault with this. I'll give it a C+.
Nice.
It's just good. It is scary. I like the monster. I like the actors. Good stuff going in there.
Rock solid. Nicely done. Okay, Pompo the Cinephile. I like it. I'm not quite sure I can bring myself to give it a full C+, because I feel like it's made for like a very specific audience.
Yeah.
And even then it's a little bit of a trifle, but I appreciate that it is made for cinephiles and has some thoughts about actual filmmaking other than it's neat. So I'm gonna give it a high C, a very, very high C. I don't think it's a must see or nothing, but I think if it's everything I said makes it sound like it would appeal to you, worth checking out. But if not, you're not gonna miss much. The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent.
That's a C. Okay. It's a little, it's way too lightweight to be anything beyond.
Nice. All right. And lastly, The Northman.
While I admire the artistry of this a lot, and some of the performances are really, really good, Robert Eggers has worked with the same cinematographer on all three of his movies so far.
It's a good looking movie.
And he was Yaron Peshki, I think is his name. Got an Academy Award nomination for The Lighthouse.
And deservedly so.
Some of the best photography you'll ever see is in The Lighthouse. So I like the look of this movie. I like sort of the richness and the textures of it, all of the visual stuff. But ultimately, it's very dissatisfying. It's all the reasons we talked about. It's just not really delving into the story in a way that makes you see why all of that artistry was necessary. So I very reluctantly give it a C-.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you on this. I'm gonna give it a very low C.
Okay.
I'm gonna give it a very low C. I think it's not like I would tell anyone to avoid it or anything like that. It's definitely, but it's actual greatness never seems to match the grandeur of the presentation. It's being presented as though it's this incredible, and there's history here, I get it, but there's not enough to it to really justify just how portentous, just how gigantic it feels. It actually feels pretty insubstantial in the long run. But again, nicely photographed, there's some cool stuff in here, it's not a total wash.
We didn't even talk about the ghost fight.
Oh, there's a ghost fight.
Yeah, there's like a straight up supernatural sequence.
We also didn't talk about how the guy who stars in The Northman as the Northman, Alexander Skarsgård, starred in the TV series True Blood as a character named Eric Northman.
Did he really?
Yeah.
I never saw True Blood.
It's not that great. I mean, the first couple seasons were interesting, and I kind of trailed off.
If you're going to have a movie about sort of national pride.
Yeah.
I mean, there aren't too many Icelandic movies with like big American money, so that
nothing
can be,
I'm aware of.
That can be admirable.
Sure.
I feel like Vikings have only been cracked once in cinema. There aren't a lot of great Viking features.
What's the one you're thinking of?
How to Train Your Dragon 2.
Yeah, that's a great one. Even though they're for some reason Scottish, I don't understand.
They're Vikings, but yeah, and they have like silly names like Hiccup and Egg Fart. I forgot what their names are, but they have silly names and. Yeah.
But
it's actually like a warm movie about like family and togetherness. Mm. It features a disabled hero, which is really rare in a lot of movies. Mm. And that movie actually like seems to understand a little bit more like the togetherness of the clan that you get from a lot of like Icelandic national epics.
The movie
you've heard of like Njal's Saga and that kind of thing.
I actually think the first two How to Train Your Dragons are great. I think the third one's fine. I just don't think it's quite up to the.
I think
the
second's the best. But
agreed.
Yeah.
But the movie I kept wanting to watch while I was watching The Northman, and I haven't seen this movie in years, and something tells me it won't hold up very good for probably some very offensive jokes. was Eric the Viking, starring Tim Robbins.
Also not very good.
No, but like it's a parody of Vikings, which is weird because it wasn't like a genre that everyone was like sort of rolling their eyes at. Oh, another Viking movie. Mm. How rife for parody.
Well, I think it was like, they were taking the Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
There wasn't like an Arthur movie that they were necessarily sending up.
Not specifically, but they were drawing sort of general idea.
It's an English film and they were drawing on an English national myth. So that made a little bit more sense. What were they getting at with the Vikings?
Like, I don't understand like why they thought the Vikings was Vikings were particularly rife for satire. But there's some funny stuff in that movie. I like the guy who's a berserker, but his father was a berserker, and his father just like looks down at his son's berserking. It's like you'll never be a real berserk. Ah! No, see, you're wasting it now. Now you don't want to do it now. This is why you're a terrible berserk.
It opens with a really horrible...
terrible.
Very, very bad taste joke about sexual assault. And
No. That part's awful. But
there is... Yeah. Although I do appreciate there's one of the characters in Eric the Viking as a Christian character.
Yeah.
He doesn't believe in the Norse gods.
Yeah, he's come to the North in order to spread the Christian gospel.
And a big part of that movie is they're trying to magically find Valhalla. They're trying to find the Viking afterworld, and they get there and it's like, well, what, don't you believe in Valhalla now? And he can't see any of it because he doesn't believe any of it.
And everyone else
through walls.
Everyone else, they can't get into Valhalla because they found it like in a ship. They didn't die in battle, which is how you get into Valhalla. So they're not allowed in, but he doesn't believe in it. So he just walks through the wall.
And they meet Thor and Odin, but they're not played by the actors you think. I won't spoil Eric the Viking, even though it's kind of a shitty movie.
There's a couple of good bits in it. There's a couple of good bits in it. There's also some stuff that I'm sure is aged very, very badly.
I think Terry Jones wrote it.
Didn't he direct it, though, right?
Eric the Viking? That wasn't Terry Jones directing it.
Yeah, surely it was.
Let me look that up, because I forgot
I'm pretty sure that was Terry Jones. Right. I know he's in it, so it's John Cleese.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, 90% sure that was Terry Jones.
Yeah, written and directed by Terry Jones.
Boom.
All right.
Got it. Nailed it in one.
And he's in it as well. He plays an Atlantean, and Atlantis sinks in the course of the movie.
Yeah. And of course, nobody move. This is not happening.
Yeah, they're in denial that it's sinking.
They're like literally trying to explain why Atlantis is not sinking while they're drowning.
No, everything's going to work out. Yeah.
Anyway, that is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back next week with a review of the new Doctor Strange and other things as well. We'll be back with more podcasts throughout the week. As I said, I'm back from vacation. Time to get back on the old horse. The podcast, not an actual horse, and definitely not heroin. I do not approve.
The Doctor Strange horse.
Yes. We got all that kind of stuff going here. We've got a bit of an update coming to the Patreon page, changing a few things around in there. We're going to actually be having some, couple times a month, we're going to be having trivia nights with our top tier patrons.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to play various trivia games with me and or Whitney, stop on by. It's a great way to do that. That's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. If you want to talk about anything we discussed on this podcast, well, gosh darn it, there's a way to do that. You can email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email in an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. Whitney, what is our P.O. box for people who prefer snail mail?
Send us an actual physical letter to send us a missive written on an animal's skin, wrapped in the hair of your greatest enemy. Send it to P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah, and once again, I want to remind everybody that there is a new book with an actual new story from M. Lopez de Silva, and the proceeds go to a very, very good cause to help trans kids in Texas, where they're trying to legislate them out of existence. The book is called Your Body Is Not Your Body. It is a queer horror anthology with a lot of really talented people behind it. You can find it on Amazon. You can buy ebooks. There's print copies available as well. It's from Tenebrous Press, Tenebrous. Any support you can give would be very supportive, very helpful. And we hope you enjoy the book, and we hope you enjoy M. Lopez de Silva's story, because I happen to think it's great. We're on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I am @LynnBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
And until next time, never forget, everyone's a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?